Rise podcast is called Leading for Business Excellence. We interview a range of leaders across all different sectors throughout the world and talk to them about what does leading for business excellence mean, what does leadership mean, what works, and what's their experience. And I think through sharing those stories, what we get is some inspiration for others to think about what they can achieve. Our latest guest is Bob Pregada, and he is the President and Chief Operating Officer for Jacobs Engineering Group. Jacobs are a Fortune 500 company, and they work across intelligence, water, infrastructure, a whole range of different services delivered by their 55,000 people in 29 different countries. Interviewing Bob was a truly inspiring experience for me. At the end of it, I wanted to get up and go and do more things, more meaningful things, to create change, to create a better place, because that's what shines through from Bob. You know, Bob has this complete sense of caring about the company he works for, the clients and customers that they service, and providing the very best service for them, the people who work for Jacobs, how to engage with them, how to support them. Over and above the sort of general day-to-day leadership, it's interesting to hear him talk about so many different subjects like diversity, inclusion, mental health. I recommend you listen to this podcast because you will feel inspired yourself at the end of it, and you'll feel inspired to do something different and something better. Welcome, Bob. Thank you so much for joining us today on our podcast. Really great to have you here.
Susanna, thank you.
I'm going to take you back to when we first met, which was at the judging sessions for the CQI International Award. Jacobs had entered for the Quality Organization of the Year. So that was in 2020. And we as a judging panel, I think one of the there were many things. You won the award, so obviously, clearly, we were impressed. But one of the things that really stood out and impressed us was that you were there, that you attended that presentation with your team. And we really felt that you were leading from the front, but not in a way that was not involved. You know, you were truly involved as a leader as well as leading from the front. And I kind of wanted to ask you, you know, is that typical of your leadership style? Does that typify how you are?
Absolutely, Susanna. I think I've been that way my entire life. But beyond me, it's in the DNA strands of Jacobs. Even going all the way back to Dr. Jacobs 70 plus years ago. In fact, our former chairman before Steve, he used to say, to be a leader at Jacobs, you have to have the bandwidth of the bedroom to the boardroom, meaning have the presence and the wherewithal to operate in a boardroom, but also when needed, and call it the bedroom from a sales proposal standpoint, but it'd be the trenches, the work site, you know, the job site, everything, but have that range. And the reason is because of our clients, right? We're a company that stands for making our clients' business a better business. But to do that, we have to understand our client's business, and we have to understand our client. And that's just not the responsibility of those that are delivering the service. It's the responsibility of the entire organization.
And that external focus, you know, is very interesting, because I think that companies that sometimes we talk to, that you see in the press and so on, they're quite internally focused. And, you know, this is about business excellence, and business excellence for us starts with thinking about the customer, but actually for an awful lot of people, it starts internally. But that's, I'm not getting that drift for Jacobs. Jacobs sounds like it's an organization, and you sound like a leader who truly believes it has to start externally with looking at your customer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's inherent in, well, you're right. I was going to say it's inherent in the service industry. You know, we are delivering a service for our clients. It's our product is our intellectual horsepower and our intellectual IP. You know, we don't have a widget. We don't have a phone. We don't have these products. The product is us. And I think in order to really deliver value for your client, that external focus and really that client intimacy, we call it, is critically important.
I like that word intimacy, because I think that you really got to get to know people, haven't you?
Yeah.
In order to understand really what's going on for them, in order to be able to deliver that service.
Absolutely. And Susanna, there's a second part to that as well, is that, you know, developing that deep understanding of your client's business and developing a strong professional, and in certain times it turns into personal relationship with your client, is really the profile of our business model, which is, you know, you hear this 80-20 rule all the time, 80% of our business is with 20% of our clients.
Yeah.
Is to get to that point we used to draw our maps and our quality rankings and our quality metrics, where, you know, you have three distinct zones of that quality spectrum. You know, the first zone is that you're trying to get to know the client. The client is trying to get to know you. But for the majority of the times, it's a relationship that's bid on either name recognition, or you're in the space of the service that the client needs. You move into the second phase. That second phase is, okay, you've done a few jobs, you've delivered a bit of value, but you're really not differentiated. I can buy that service from Susanna or Lauren or Bob. It doesn't really matter, because Bob, Susanna, and Lauren are all kind of equal. Then that, if you can continue to deliver value, differentiated value in that zone, you get to where we aspire to. And that is, you know, that client advocacy, where, you know, that client, the client becomes an apostle for you as you're delivering value for them. And, you know, that's kind of the zone that we aspire to with all of our clients. And so that's how you end up getting 20, 30, 40, 50 year client relationships.
And so to get to that zone, Bob, you know, you've got 50,000 employees there or thereabouts. That's a lot of people who've got to be in the zone. How do you achieve that?
Culture. A strong, strong culture that stands for having a positive influence on the world and is a purpose-driven culture. We have 8,000 people leaders, you know, in the organization, but even those 8,000 are also delivering service back to the, you know, it's at all ranks, are delivering service for the client as well. To create an environment and a culture where everybody feels empowered and everybody feels included is a big part of how you have that influence on 55,000 people in 26 different countries around the world.
Yeah. That definitely was something that came through. I go back to the award presentation. That was so strong. It was impressive to see the unity of purpose amongst your team that were presenting. And it was incredibly authentic, which, you know, is the goal, isn't it? I mean, obviously, that's what we're all hoping we can achieve. But you don't see it a lot. And it defined and separated you completely.
Well, Susanna, thank you. It means a lot, especially because you get to see not only us, but our competitors and those that, you know, operate in the same space that we do. It's something that we work really, really hard on. But I'll say that, you know, we're constantly transforming the company. But a few things stay constant, right? Our culture of caring, our culture of safety, whether that be physical safety or mental safety. And the top on the list is a culture of inclusion and diversity. Is that, you know, in order to create this purpose-driven culture, we have to have an environment where everybody feels included, regardless of their gender, what they look like, who they love, what part of the world they're in. We need to have that to where you can bring your authentic self to work every single day. Then, as they sometimes jokingly say, make it rain. And then the rain starts to come, because it's, you know, humans can do great things.
Yes.
If you just unleash their real talent.
We hear a lot of it in the news, don't we? And we hear a lot about how, you know, raising the profile of inclusion and diversity, in particular, ensuring that our employees feel engaged,
right?
Because sadly, so many don't. And because so many don't, then not everybody's doing this. So presumably they're not doing it either because they don't necessarily know about it, or because they're busy doing other things, or they're investing their time and money in other areas that they think are more important and will drive better results for them. So I'm quite interested that you and Jacobs see that this is where it's worth the investment, because it's going to cost you time and energy and money. And as you say, interestingly, you're constantly transforming. So you can't do it once and then it's all over by May. You've got to keep going. So what is it about that that makes that difference and that you're willing to make that investment?
I think you said it really well just a minute ago when you talked about engagement. You know, engaged employees are employees that want to contribute out of a real sense of ownership and commitment. Yes, we all get paychecks. We all have our own personal lives. We have families. We have obligations that we have to uphold. But that engagement is what we're driving for. And you know, Susanna, in the last, especially what we're dealing with right now, and I keep saying that over and over and over again over the course of the last 2 years, it's now more important than it ever has, I think, at least in my several years of life as well, because it seems like just at the point where we as a global society need to be coming together for a common cause, tragically, you know, you see a lot of instances where we're becoming more polarized as a human society. I'm not talking about Jacobs, but of course we're a subset. So, you know, those are things that I think we need to be really, really sensitive to. And that actually even causes us to, back to transforming, you know, knowing that what worked in the past doesn't necessarily work in the future as far as motivating and inspiring. There are a few common things, but I think you just got to continue to relate and understand what that formula is.
Because one of the things that we really noticed, maybe the first 6 months of the pandemic, maybe even shorter than that, actually, was the speed at which organizations, you know, were able to make change. So we would talk to organizations who typically had perhaps large call centers where everybody came in every day and they worked their shifts on the phone every day. And there was no flexibility in their working practices. That is how they had to be. And of course, suddenly that wasn't an option anymore. So they were able to transform their processes really rapidly and get everyone working from home. And we ran a survey asking people how long they thought it would take them if they had suddenly implemented, without a pandemic, a working from home policy for call center staff. You know, and they said 2 years or not at all was the best vote for that. So it's been really interesting the speed at which organizations have been able to create change, have had to create change over the last 2 years. And I think that the attention to their employees and customers in that period sometimes has been a challenge because they've been so involved in the kind of just, let's just keep the plates spinning. You know, let's try and maintain some sense of business as usual. And how have you found that for Jacobs?
I have to go back to when it all started 2 years ago, because as you were talking, Susanna, we were identical in that. And it kind of shows the dynamic around the world. And so to start off, and it was 2 years to the week, 2 years to the week, I got a call from our head of global safety and health and security. And he says, Bob, this virus that we're reading about in the news that's affecting China has now hit Hong Kong. And we have 450 people in Hong Kong. And the local government is telling all business owners to shut down their businesses and work from home. So we did it. And it was lumpy. And we actually didn't know, you know, how to work through the mechanics, but everything was still new. SARS-1 actually had a dramatic effect there. So let's go ahead and do it. Susanna, 2 weeks later, the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, New Zealand. 2 weeks later, India. 2 weeks later, Italy. Within 6 weeks from the second week of January, then I'm getting a call from our operations in Seattle saying, Bob, they've just shut down Seattle. And then after that, it was day for day for day. Finally, when it hit, and this is tragic, but this is the way it worked, in the U.S., when it got to Europe, then it was like, okay, something's happening here. And then when it got to the US, within a week, we had taken 35,000 people, put them into the home environment. And we ended up having about 15 to 20,000 employees that still had to go to job sites. We operate and maintain public utilities in major metropolitan cities. we operate in and are involved with very high-end defense security agencies. Those don't shut down on a pandemic.
Yeah, you can't just switch that off.
You can't switch that off. And so we had to make precautions for all of them moving into an environment where they were going in shifts and they were doing all kinds of different things, protecting themselves against a virus that nobody really knew much about. So you look back on it now, 2 years later, and you think to yourself, wow, this is something that, right, if it wasn't driven, I mean, heck, it took us 2 months when we saw that there was a virus, you know, in the Far East. And it still took 2 months for us to respond until it affected us. If there wasn't a virus, I think the 2 year example is a great one.
Yes. And then it's, of course, and then having established new ways of working, how do you then re-engineer your organization and culture to take that into account? Because a lot of people have experienced enormous change themselves, particularly financially. You know, a lot of employees saying, well, actually, I haven't had to commute for the last year, 18 months, and that saved me a lot. And I'm doing my job really well. So how do we then transform to build in new needs, new wants from our people? Yeah. And presumably customers too, because customers want us to behave in a different way with them too.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, looking at it from a glass half full, there were some silver linings from what we've all learned. And one of them is exactly, Susanna, what you just said. You know, this hybrid work model, which is what we call it, has allowed the flexibility for people to adjust their ability to work as well as stay very engaged in their personal lives. That has been a godsend and has really promoted, actually it's promoted recruiting different demographics that we probably were underserved in the past. So that's been a real positive. The part that we struggled with was, and maybe this is also a Western phenomenon as well, is we did have, well, there's two main items. We did have a group of employees that, you know, we think that we have homes, we have a bedroom that you can work in, we have different places where you can at least escape and do your work. We also have employees that live in, you know, I'll use the English metrics, 1,000 square feet with a family of five, and they're working on the kitchen table. They can't do that for that much longer. So though we had to balance all of that as we were trying to work in this first everybody at home and then in this hybrid model. And so and quite frankly, technology has been just an unbelievable catalyst to help us manage through that.
Yes. And I think that I remember talking to one CEO who said, from the technology that I have seen us implement to enable this hybrid working change, this was kind of July, maybe 2020. He said, we've got all of these digital assets and we're not doing very much with them at all in terms of how we manage our processes or automating processes so that we can get people to work smarter and better and use their brains more effectively where we can get the technology to do the grunt work. So that have you seen that too? Have you seen more use of technology and digital tools?
Beyond anything that I could have ever imagined. I got two examples, Susanna, to talk about. One is that this is something that actually was, again, an accelerant of something that we had started actually 20 years ago, where we have tremendous amount of intellectual talent. It doesn't all sit in one location. We don't have huge centers. We have a few, but for the most part, our 400 plus offices are spread all over the world. What we've been working on for the last several years has been, we have a very localized business, or when we're performing consulting services or engineering or some form of scientific service to a location, old school thinking, all the people that are involved with, and I'll use a water treatment plant, would be in the locale of where the water treatment plant is. What we tried to do is say, no, we've got global talent that we can then integrate and connect to deliver a solution locally. And in certain end markets, like advanced facilities and a few other end markets, water, we were able to make some real headway on that. But then the human culture element and the human paradigm element came into play. if I don't have in my cubicle direct line of sight to Susanna and she's on my project team, well, how am I going to manage her work when I'm in a project team trying to deliver a service and a project to my client? So we dealt with that for several years as well. Well, then forget about if I'm in London or I'm in Dallas or I'm in Mumbai or Singapore. The pandemic hits. If I'm in Dallas, I can't even see the person that lives next door to me, right? Forget about 10,000 miles away. I'm looking at the person on a screen. Our integrated delivery, our global delivery ended up going through the roof. Because then it was, no, I can see Susanna. I can get to know Susanna. She's not sitting next to me. But now I can use both of our talents to really enhance the offering for the client. So that was a huge, huge accelerant for us in what we do.
Brilliant. And so out of interest, going back to the hybrid sense and really to your point about that management, about how they get people together when they've got some people who are located on site or in an office and some people who are working at home. So how are you finding you're making those connections with people? And I guess I kind of also mean from a kind of like a rhythm, a behaviors.
Yeah. Well, we started off with almost the deluge effect. I think people thought, hey, you know what? We've got this thing called Microsoft Teams or Zoom or whatever. There's 24 hours in a day. And the sensitivity that at some point you need to stop working and maybe eat or sleep. We were doing calls every day for 20 hours a day because we weren't used to getting into that rhythm of, okay, we have scheduled calls. At 6 o'clock, I'm going to turn my computer off. I'm going to sit down with my family. I'm going to have a meal, those types of things. That didn't come until later. I'd say within 2 to 3 months, then we started to see the rhythm come through.
Right.
But then whatever the opposite of a silver lining is, I don't know the opposite of silver, the non-silver lining, let's call it.
The cloud.
Started to have the cloud, right. The dark cloud started to come on. And that was what I think is going to be the pandemic that will stay with us for a long time. And that was the mental health aspect. You know, we did start to hit a period where people just were really getting mentally fatigued and we could see it in our employee base. So again, we had already had mental health awareness and positive mental health as a really, really high priority for us in our company. And so we started to really concentrate on focusing on that aspect of what was happening to our people.
Yes. And are you able to give us some examples, the sort of things that you've been doing? I think it'd be really interesting for people to get ideas from.
Sure. Maybe I can make an unabashed plug for one of our platforms too,
because go for it.
There's no proprietary rights here. We want everybody in the industry and industries that we're not even in either to use this. It's called the 1 Million Lives platform.
Okay.
And what it is it's a mental health check-in platform where you go on, you answer a few questions, and the tool, the platform, can give you some indication on, hey, here's what you're feeling. Here's what your emotions are saying. You know, things that sometimes we can't discern ourselves because we all think we're superwoman and superman. And we just keep plowing through and plowing through. This will really cause people to take a pause and to reflect and even give some counsel and guidance on things that you could do in order to maybe moderate your mental health stress. It also can identify when you might need some professional help, which, you know, sometimes we can't acknowledge that as well. So that was a big platform that we had actually, ironically enough, we had already put in place nearly 4 years before the pandemic even hit. The other thing that we've done is we've set up platforms, both internal to the company as well as we call it employee assistance program, where people can call and get help and it'd be completely anonymous. But I think of all of those, the piece that I go back to is actually how you started off the podcast, which is the connection to leadership. Just picking up the phone and calling any one of us and saying, I'm not really feeling well today and this has happened and this has happened, and just having a conversation and acknowledging that it's okay not to be okay. And we have a network and we have a Jacobs family that you can lean on.
I'm going to say some old-fashioned, you know, learned behaviors about not being willing, brave enough, comfortable, you know, choose the word that works best for you, about sharing those emotions in the workplace. And it, you know, it's time that that wasn't a thing anymore. It's time to move on. And for, but of course, then leaders need some training themselves in how to cope with that too. So if someone comes to me, yeah, from my team and talks to me, I need to have some skills, don't I, to be able to know how to respond too. So there's that responsibility again in the organization to ensure that everybody's equipped for both sides of that.
Absolutely.
Problem.
And I think we talked about it in our interview with you. We have a program called Mental Health Champions. And we probably have a couple of thousand mental health champions that do receive a certain level of training. And it's not for now for us to have thousands of psychiatrists and psychologists in the company. We're engineers and we're technicians and we come from kind of that vintage, but it's more of an awareness. In fact, I treat it as sound management and leadership training, because it really, it helps leaders to identify what to look for, what to hear, signals, and then how to respond and how to go get maybe even further assistance. And so that's been great. So we took our senior leadership team, kind of the top couple of hundred in the organization, and made sure that everybody got that training. And then as we were doing that, all of our safety professionals, and the next thing you know, you wake up and you've got mental health champions all over the organization, and it really instills a high sense of pride.
Yeah, pride and normality.
Yes.
This is a normal thing now, and it's okay.
Right. I mean, I can remember, and of course, I started my career off in the military, but I was thinking back, and I'll go ahead and say it, 30 years ago. And if I was a young person coming out of school and was struggling and went to my immediate supervisor and said, I'm struggling, I'm not okay, I think you know what the response would have been.
Exactly.
First of all, you never said it. And even if you did said it, you didn't tell your supervisor.
No.
And so we want to definitely change that paradigm. It's overdue.
You mentioned that you started your career in the Navy. I was going to ask you about that. And I guess I'm interested in how you think that shaped you as a leader.
So I did. I actually, in the U.S., we have service academies, and I went to the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And I think, you know, the way I got to the Naval Academy, really, it was my mother who kind of put the idea in my head a long time ago when I was a small boy. I'm son of immigrants. She didn't really even know about these type of universities. She ended up befriending somebody whose son went to West Point, the Army version of that. And oh, by the way, we had no money. She said, and it's free. You have to go serve in the military afterwards. I'm like, okay, Mom, let's do it. And then you learn more about the school in the environment of, now this is going to sound familiar, a merit-based organization that is extremely inclusive. The roots aren't. If you go back, you know, decades and decades ago, it wasn't. But I'd say I felt more at home in the Navy because regardless of what your function was, what you did, everybody wore this badge that said United States Navy on it. And you wouldn't know the other person, but you would see that the organization, and you felt an immediate bond. It's no different than what we're trying to create at Jacobs as well. And it was a bond of a platform that was trying to do good in the world, right? And keep people safe. And so I think, you know, my takeaway from not just going to Annapolis, but also the 10 years that I served in the Navy, it was all about that. And it was all about having a positive influence on people and on the world.
And on the world, you have created And let me hope I get this right, an Office of Global Climate Response and ESG.
We have.
Is that right?
We have.
Have I got that correct?
You did.
So that's beyond, again, the internal remit, if you like, of Jacobs. So that's, I'm quite interested in how that responsibility, as you talk about.
Yeah, Susanna, it was almost like a natural. If you look at the fundamental doctrine behind ESG, and then you were to compare that to the core values of Jacobs, it was a natural fit. you know, whether it be the environmental piece, the social piece, the governance, it was like, wait a second, this represents us as a company today, but we actually never kind of acknowledged it or even thought about it from that perspective. So as we started to do, whether it was service that we deliver to our clients, whether it be in the infrastructure space or the manufacturing space, the security space, we started to put things together and say, wait a second, we do this for our clients every day. If you looked at the social piece and you go back to what we're doing around inclusion and diversity and trying to have a positive influence on the communities that we serve, it was a natural fit. If you look at the strong fundamentals of governance, whether it be at our board level or leadership, you know, it was what we were doing. However, we had never put any structure around it. And so, you know, this office that we created puts structure around it. It also puts metrics by which we can measure ourselves. You know, the old adage, it's very difficult to hold yourself accountable if you can't measure what you're doing. Put metrics around it, hold ourselves accountable for delivering this, not only for our clients, but also our people and our shareholders. And it's been a great start. Jan Wahlstrom and Zoe Haseman are really right in the middle of it from a leadership standpoint, but it spans all 55,000 of our people, from the CEO all the way down.
You must have a system for creating that communication and engagement process, because, you know, you're really clear that spans all 55,000 people.
It does.
You know, I feel like if I walked into your office in Seattle and went and found, you know, somebody who was answering the phone, that they'd understand and they'd know what this was. I could ask them about it. So what makes you so sure that that really is true?
Because I think that if someone is going to, one, be comfortable, and two, continue to feel at home at Jacobs, they're going to embrace these principles. And if they don't, they're likely not going to, sadly, not going to be with us. And so it gives you that comfort that, no, if you look at the lagging indicators on performance, you know, we have a high performing organization. But then if you go upstream of that and say, well, what's driving that performance? Yes, it's innovative thinking and it's technology and it's solving critical issues for our clients. Then you go upstream of that and you go, well, why is Jacobs getting the best people in the world to do that? And then you come back to culture, right? It's a place where I remember when we came together with CH2M, transformational acquisition that we made. I remember in the early days of integration, I said to a team, I forgot where I was. I said to a team, the question from the crowd came and said, hey, what do you see from a recruiting and from how others outside of the company think about Jacobs? And I said, that's a good question. And right off the cuff, and I remember it, but I've used it then time and time again. I said, I want our clients and our competitors and our shareholders to look at Jacobs and say, hey, what's happening there? They're winning all the work. Their employee engagement's high. And most importantly, it seems as if they're having fun. Yeah. They're having fun at what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think we have to. We spend so much time in our professional life. If we're not having fun, then what's it use?
Absolutely. No, I know. I couldn't agree more. So as a leader, we always think about how leaders have to work what we would call on the system. In other words, they're leading the system. They're making these decisions about what are our strategic priorities? Where are we going to invest? How are we performing? Those are the working on the system. But there's also the behaviors that, you know, I've seen from you, I've talked about, which is about, you know, being involved and working in the system itself. So ensuring operations do deliver. How do you separate your time between those?
Yeah. To put it as X percent goes this way and Y percent goes that way, that probably would be unfair because it's a continuum.
Okay.
And it's a continuum that you don't want to get overweighted in one side or the other. And the sides that I'm describing are, yes, there's a rigor and there's a level of discipline on our KPIs, right? And we have, you know, a set of KPIs by which we manage the business, but they're all lagging in nature. There are some leading ones, but they're mostly lagging. Kind of the ultimate lagging one is our financial performance. Right? If you're doing all of these things well, you'll financially perform. Sometimes companies get that in reverse. We're only going to do these things in order to financially perform well. And we kind of look at it a little differently. That's on one side. On the other side is, you said it appropriately before, is engagement. And that, Susanna, is that's something that, yes, we can do surveys, and we do, and we can get feedback in town halls and different types of things, and we do. But then there's also a guttural piece too, you know, having these days on you know, video conference, but having that one-on-one engagement, or the one-on-five, or the small kind of unit engagement, and hearing what our employees are saying, it's no different than what we do to our clients or our shareholders, and taking that and really taking it to heart. There could be some filtering process, you know, here and there, but for the most part, take it for exactly what it is at face value. And what's most important, especially to the employee, as well as actually I say that as well to the client and to the shareholder too, and taking action on it. You know, employee engagement and feedback is only going to keep coming and be sincere if the stakeholders can only see that there's actually actions coming back.
Sure.
And so that, you know, both sides is something that I'd say is how we at Jacobs define, you know, the role of a leader.
And that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think that, it reminds me of the sort of stories, the old stories, perhaps, of the old suggestion box.
Yeah.
You know, so a company implements a suggestion box. You've got any continuous improvement ideas? Put them in the box. And then once a month we'll go, oh, marvelous, we had six. But actually, people stop putting anything in the box if they don't see anybody doing anything about it. Or the leader's coming back and saying, we had these ideas. Let me tell you why. We're going to do these things, but we're actually not going to do those things. And perhaps we are going to hold this group for the future. It has to be the leadership that do the last piece, isn't it? That actually add that extra layer on top to make it valuable.
There is.
Otherwise, people are just, they're just not going to bother.
No. Susanna, it actually goes back, the three zones of client engagement that I was talking about. You could almost parallel that to the zones of employee engagement. And what I mean is this, because here's the other side that we have to be careful, because there's a natural human instinct to want to make everybody happy. And trust me, I am culprit number 1, 10, 100. I'm on that list several times. But trying to get to that strong client intimacy and the client being an apostle for you, you could also replace client with employee, is having that tough conversation with the client as well. The client is headed in a direction. It's likely not going to end up well. And so having that critical conversation with the client to say, we're going in this direction, and having the courage to acknowledge maybe we Jacobs maybe put you in this position, but it's our responsibility to have that conversation with you and advocate for going in X direction or going in Y direction. Those are some of the hardest conversations I've ever had, but it's what's led to long-term relationships. Had we just said, Mr. and Ms. Client, you told us to do this, we did this, the project failed, but we're not culpable, that relationship ends quickly.
Indeed.
You're probably not going to do another job for that.
No, absolutely. Yeah. But also, I don't know about you, but I've also found that sometimes out of those really difficult conversations that you have to prepare for, but you do dread, you know, I know I have dreaded some, often the best things come out that would never have happened had we not been brave enough to have them, had we not had that courage.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got dozens upon dozens of examples where we did have that critical conversation with a client. We did get fired. The client did go elsewhere on the next program or project or engagement, and then came back. And then came back and said, oh, okay, I get it. I now know what you did. So even in situations where it doesn't go, you know, if you were to do a Pareto chart on it, there's more times that it works than much more by a multiple than it doesn't.
So for you, when you think about, we talk about leadership, but also talking about, you know, the importance of management as well. What do you think are the few qualities that separate leadership and management?
That separate leadership from management.
Separated in terms of perhaps the role, perhaps the thinking. A lot of people who would be listening to this podcast, maybe management wanting to move into leadership. So I think it's interesting to hear your view on how do you, you know, what is it that you need to be doing and thinking and behaving, paying attention to in order to help elevate yourself?
I see one as foundational to the next, right? I mean, if you even to make it a pyramid. And so the attributes I would see, you know, in strong management, number one are competence. A competency in whatever it is that you're managing, but your employees see that you do have the abilities and the competence to do what you're doing. And therefore, there's engagement from your employee. I think as you then transcend into leadership, and what separates is this level of caring and this level of, we're talking about employee engagement, leadership engagement into what you're doing. And then this level of confidence, right? But confidence with humility. And so if you then say, yes, one's foundational to the other, but then how do you separate it? How do you discern between a leader and a manager? A leader has to have competence in order to get to the level of leadership. But then a sense of caring and a sense of, and I tell my sons this all the time, is confidence with humility. And I think that's what epitomizes, if I look at the great leaders have had an influence on me over the course of my life, not even my professional career, but my personal life, it's been those items.
I couldn't agree more. And I think those are perfect words to describe that. I think it's quite different, isn't it? You know, because we often hear people talk about strength and drive, for instance. And I could imagine some people being surprised that actually caring is that quality.
I think that, and we feel this way at Jacobs, a leader that has enough confidence in himself or herself to show vulnerability, it's an important leadership attribute, because we're, at the end of the day, we're all humans and we all have vulnerabilities and we all have fears. And sharing those is not, in my mind, sharing those is not a sign of weakness. It's actually a sign of strength. And I think that's important, you know, especially in the new world that we live in, where everybody can see everything all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And people don't think that leaders are weak if they admit, actually, I'm not quite sure what we should be doing here, but I tell you what, I've got a great bunch of people around me and I'm going to get their counsel.
Exactly. And we're going to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the confidence.
There was a saying. So when you join the Naval Academy, you go through this indoctrination program. It's called plebe summer. You're a plebeian coming from the old, you know, the Roman term, he or she that has nothing and is a nobody.
Right.
Right. So they break you down. You have what's called plebe summer and you're a plebe the entire year. And your first day when you show up and you're getting hazed and harassed and everything else, but the upperclassmen tell you there's only certain responses to questions that you get asked. It's either, and I'll take the sir or ma'am out, right? It's either yes, it's no, or it's I'll find out. Or it's the answer, right? But you're not going to fake an answer. You're either going to say it and stand behind it, or you're going to say yes, or you're going to say no. And if you have none of those three options, I'll find out. And I think that's, you know, that's something that gets ingrained in you when you're a 17-year-old kid that shows up.
Absolutely.
And it stayed with me the rest of my life.
Quite liberating, actually.
Yeah.
you know, quite liberating to know that actually I have got three great options and all of them are okay. You know?
Right.
So who would you say has possibly had the most influence on you as a leader?
Actually, I would say my mother.
Okay.
My mother. We were talking about strength. You know, first of all, she's the strongest person, man or woman alike, that I've ever known in my life. And the reason why I say my mother is that, you know, my mom came to the U.S. when she was 20 years old in an environment, and now I'm going to date myself, in an environment in the 60s that was not the most inclusive, put it that way, and had a child kind of thrust upon her 9 months later, and a husband that, and I'm really showing vulnerabilities here, that that had some mental health issues.
Okay.
And left her alone a lot. And through every single situation, and you flash forward even to now, right, 53 years later, she figured out a way to make it work. And she did it knowing that she wasn't Superwoman, but her ability to influence and engage a network of people to either raise a child, have a job, you know, provide for her family, which was me. You know, you read about these stories and now they make movies about them and everything else. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, I think we ought to write a book or make a movie about you. And so
absolutely,
there's been other leaders. I could talk about other leaders that I've had in the professional world and the military and everything else. But you go back and you're like, what's the one common denominator that had the biggest influence on me? It's my mom.
And I think that courage is, you know, that's what I hear you describe, which I really admire about that, not being afraid to ask.
Yeah.
I'll find out. You know, I'll find out right. Someone from my network who can help me support in this situation. That courage to do that, to be prepared to think creatively and think about all the people you know and can involve and who can support you, that's a lesson that will just ensure future success.
Absolutely.
Because if that's all you have, my God, that's a fantastic set of assets.
Oh, absolutely. Suzanne, I'll tell you a short story. I don't think that I've told this before, but again, in the spirit of showing vulnerabilities. So my father worked for, ironically enough, in a big engineering company called Bechtel. We were in the South. It was in the early, mid 70s. He had passed at this point. And we were at a grocery store, and I'm an 8-9 year old kid, growing boy. And so I wanted this, I wanted that, I wanted this. We get to the grocery line. And back then, you remember there's no digital back then. They're punching in the keystrokes and everything else. And we're seeing the numbers show up, and I'm a little kid, so I really didn't know. And then I could see this look overwhelm my mom, like, oh boy, this is going to be tough. And we get to the total. She doesn't have enough. So we started to take out, and now we started to do kind of long math to say, okay, if we take this out, we take that, we take this out. And I remember taking this food back into the aisles and walking back. And I still remember to this day, my mom, even I just saw my mom over the holidays and we talked about it.
Okay.
And I said, she felt terrible.
Mm.
We're crying in the car afterwards. And I said to her just a couple of weeks ago, I said, Mom, that singular lesson stayed with me for the rest of my life and actually even partly shaped me. Now, you know, in a world where I know my two sons are wonderful, wonderful boys, and they do have value for things. But today it's about not what you have to put back. It's how much more you want. Right. And so having that, knowing where you came from and knowing how valuable, in this case, it was food. But knowing how valuable, you know, things are and knowing what your limitations are and then building on them is incredible learning.
Yes. Yes. That's a great story. I truly appreciate you sharing that. Thank you. My last question for today is if you could choose to reincarnate as any leader, who would you come back as and why?
Well, first of all, interesting question, Susanna, because I do come from the Hindu faith.
Yes.
And so I do believe in reincarnation. You know, I would say Gandhi. And the reason, and not just because of, you know, my ethnic background or anything else, but just as a world leader who had a tremendous impact, not only in the generations that he lived in, but all of the generations that followed. You know, Gandhi passed 70 years ago. And today, his readings and his philosophies are incorporated in so many of our, you know, our approaches to everything in the world. And I think, you know, there's one person, one small, frail man who had an impact on billions of people in real time and then billions after. Sometimes I get the question in a different way. I get the question is, if you could have lunch with anybody present or past,
yeah,
you know, who would you have sometimes lunch, sometimes even dinner. If you could have a beer with somebody, right? Who would you have a beer with?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I would say him.
And that choice, I think that for me, that sums up everything that I think I've heard you talk about today as the most important things. So the qualities of caring, the qualities of humility, but confidence, belief, courage, it's going to stay with me from this conversation. I really appreciate it, Bob. Thank you very, very much for your time today.
Susanna, thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
I'm really glad. Good. Thank you. I really hope you enjoyed this episode, Leading for Business Excellence with Bob Pregada. If you'd like to know more about how you can develop your career in business excellence and transform your organisation, please drop us a line, team@pmi.co.uk. I'd love to hear from you.